Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and in your appeal to heaven, as we have kind of laid it out, we need to continue to learn so we understand more so that we can actually ask and articulate our needs and requirements to heaven so that we learn, pray, and act upon these new understandings, doing those things that we need to be doing. So, as we move into the next obligatory, kind of the final one, actually the two final ones, we're focused on constitutional compliance. It's not just the oath. It is the legal requirement based on the Constitution. So even though the oath, Article 6 and the oath is important, anybody that says it's all about the oath, no, the oath is the initial obligatory. It is basically the true constrictor. In other words, when you go into office, it's kind of like baptism. You're cleansed, or you're kind of washed free, and now you have to follow the law, because any violation, any sin, that'll be held against you. So it's the same thing with the oath. You've taken this oath of office. Now, to be honest, the way the oath works, every infraction, the next time you take an oath because you get reelected, doesn't mean the slate has been cleaned. If we find out, we the people, if we find out that you actually sinned in a previous term, then you are to be removed. Doesn't matter if you have been good this term. If we find out that you sinned, then you are to be removed. And this scares people. As a matter of fact, this is the primary reason why nobody wants to enforce this law. Now, I believe that we should be able to move forward by forgiving some transgressions. In other words, any person that walks into office into the state legislature, whether they're senator first time, the first time House of Representatives, and let's say they've been functioning, and they've just been taught what to do and how to do it, that to vote on these things. I mean, let's look at it this way. You got elected and you go into office, and halfway through your term, in the first year, they pass this law that is going to hold everybody accountable, and that law goes into effect in the next session. Come to find out, everybody in that first session with you, or that first, the first session of your, it's not a session, the first year of your session, because the session is 2 years. So the first year of that session, everybody voted on a bill that, come to find out, actually violated the Constitution. I believe the measure, the threshold, or the bar that we need to be using moving forward, and this is what the state legislatures need to get their, arms around. Same thing with county representatives, everybody. And we're only focused on the representatives. Why? Because that's our government. We don't have a judiciary form of government. We do not have a monarchical form of government, so our executive is not our king. It's not where we need to be focused. We don't petition the king. We petition our representatives. We don't petition the court, even though the court wants us to petition, because when we petition the court, they make money. Your representatives make hardly anything. And as a matter of fact, the only reason government costs as much as it does is because of the courts. Anyway, I'm down a rat hole, so let me get back out of this. So the bottom line is that we need to actually start ensuring that there's this threshold, or that the representatives kind of understand, okay, you didn't know and you didn't ask. That's shame on you. This is your first and final. Moving forward, you better ask, is this, if you don't know for sure whether this is a legitimate bill that you're going to vote on, because if it's an illegitimate bill, it should never have made it to the floor. How is it that illegitimate bills that literally violate the Constitution, like the currency bills that came out into most of the states in the past couple of years, where they started voting on whether they were going to allow digital currency to function in their state? That was a direct violation to the Constitution. How did it even get into the state legislatures, onto the floor for them to vote on? How did it get there? Why is there not some filter on the very front end of this that actually identifies what is constitutional, what isn't constitutional, so that they won't make that mistake? Does that make sense? Does that make sense? I mean, come on. This is common sense and logic, right? So as the representatives, they need to actually look at whether a person was basically running roughshod over the Constitution because, hey, we're going to bring this in and this is what we're going to do. Because if they don't even ask questions and they're actually driving a unconstitutional, like health care, you know, and Nancy Pelosi, these people knew what they were doing. They knew that they were driving these new changes, these new powers. They were going to be opening up a can of whoop butt on the American people. And so just didn't want to say ass, you know. Anyway, so the point is that they have to have this threshold to really look to see whether the person had batted an eye, whether they questioned it. And as a matter of fact, the only acceptable behavior moving forward is you better question it before you make that decision. You better say, is this constitutional? Because if somebody tells you that and you get it in writing, like the Speaker of the House in your state legislature or the President Pro Tem or what have you, whatever they call the grand poobah of your Senate, then, and they say, yes, this is constitutional, then okay, you have somebody that you can point to say, they told me this was constitutional. I didn't know. Because I understand that we have a real problem because we have got a league. I mean, how many legislators are serving in the state legislatures and even in your county legislatures that understands the Constitution? You know, if I was those folks, I remember when I was in the Corps and I, you know, took my oath to support and defend the Constitution, I started understanding exactly what that meant so that I wouldn't be caught violating that oath, because that's a legally binding oath. Now, back to this concept, the oath is only, you know, the key is the constraint that it has to be placed upon you. That means you've now been legally constrained to support this. The real teeth, the real thing that we have to focus on is holding everybody accountable. So in other words, when you hear organizations, and you know, I know there's a lot of John Birchers that listen to the show because they constantly, he gouged us again. He went after us again. He's attacked us again. Because they tend to do things as a matter of fact, they're kind of like, I don't want to say they're the gold standard, but they've made themselves believe and make a lot of people believe that they are the gold standard when they're really not. But the fact is that when you look at the concept of the oath, that is the constriction that is now legally placed upon you in this term. Therefore, the real thing we have to focus on are two things after the constriction, or after the oath. So in other words, the thing that we need to start promoting and helping educate everybody, this is what we're learning here, is the petitioning of the public servant. You have to petition them when they violate the oath. It's not holding them just accountable. You got to use a First Amendment petition for the redress of grievances. You just don't go out and stand there. I mean, if the person was honorable, then all you'd have to do is impugn their character to say, that was a violation of your oath. That's all you really have to do. But we actually have a legal process that was embedded prior to the Constitution. It goes all the way back to the Magna Carta. It was in paragraph 61 where the concept of petitioning for the redress of grievances was placed into the Magna Carta. So anyway, and that's probably a document that we should probably dive into, but that's ancillary. I don't think I'll ever go there. But I welcome everybody to read the Magna Carta, the Glorious Bill of Rights, because those were pivotal points in the evolution of liberty and governing as we were, you know, kind of on our way to becoming what we are today as a hybrid constitutional republic. So, again, it is Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. That is the most important clause when it comes to the law, because this is the gold standard. You had to take your oath to support the Constitution, and if you don't, Section 3 kicks in, because Section 3 is an automatic process. There's no due process here. This is automatic process that you were to be removed. You step down now. You don't stand in front of people to try to state your case. If you feel that you have a good grievance to say, hey, this is wrong. This is just wrong. Then you need to go to a common law court and plead your case to whether it be a grand jury or whether it be a common law court in your county or wherever you were elected in that area of election so that the people can gather together a chosen, respective, representative of the area that you got elected in so that those people will hear your case and give you the verdict, whether you violated the law or not. Now, this will actually kind of save your butt if you can prove that you didn't violate the Constitution. Good luck. And I can only see one way that you might be able to save yourself. Because overall, if you're in a situation where it doesn't matter what you do, you'll be violating the Constitution. In other words, you've been put in between the rock and a hard spot because the Speaker of the House or, the legislative, control office that brings in the bills, you have to vote on a bill. And bottom line, just because you voted one way or the other on a bill, you've violated your oath. If that scenario could even exist, then that would be one of those to say, I couldn't do either way. Everybody that was involved in that should have been removed. And to me, it is all about holding them accountable. So let me back out of this hole, this rat hole, and basically say, we want you to understand the importance. What is the whole point of what we need to do? We need to hold every public servant accountable to the oath in fully supporting the Constitution. And becoming not only a guardian, but ensuring that they oppose every infraction that is occurring within their legislature or within the legislature above that you're responsible for overseeing, i.e., the states should be overseeing the federal government, the county should be overseeing your state legislature, the people should be overseeing your county legislature. That is the process. So if it falls into your realm, and folks, I'm telling you, it falls into every person's realm. Every citizen has the responsibility of making sure all three levels are working properly. If we don't hold them accountable, then they're going to get away with murder, and that's one of the reasons why people are dying from vaccinations and so forth, because that's murder. They put it out there to kill people, not all people. But whatever they're doing and people end up dying, then they knew what the risks were and the design was baked into it, that people were going to die. Whether it be chemtrails, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And so the bottom line, this is warfare. They're actually waging aggressive tactics against we, the people in the states. And we actually have to step in and get them to realize that they are a part of a prosecution of war that that they're not supposed to be doing. They don't even realize. Oh, they've been doing this for years, right? Anyway, the other obligatory is I'm running a campaign. If you want to be an elector, just contact me. If you'd like to be an elector for president and vote for me, and actually run a campaign for G.R. Mobley for president, then let me know, and we will start working together so that we can contact your Secretary of State and start working out those details of what it's going to take to get you on the ballot so that you can be an elector instead of allowing the county, or I should say, the state party in determining who the electors are going to be. This is so unconstitutional, folks, and the party doesn't want you to know it. Now, what we've been going through, we've kind of covering the Utah Enabling Act. And so with the Utah Enabling Act, we already covered the very first part of this. And so the first part that I just read, and we really didn't have time to kind of dive into it, but what I want to do, because this is all in Section 3, and this is the first part of the requirements that the federal government is exercising. In other words, here are the gotchas, right? Now, the federal government, let me start off with Section 3 at the beginning, because we kind of just finished reading the first part, and there's other parts to this. You know, Section 3, then there's first, second, third, fourth. Anyway, Section 3 states this, that the delegates to the convention thus elected shall meet at the seat of government of said territory on the first Monday in March 1895, and after organization shall declare on behalf of the people of the said proposed state that they adopt the Constitution of the United States, whereupon the said convention shall be and is hereby authorized to form a constitution and state government for the said purposes of the state. The Constitution shall be republican in form and make no distinction in civil or political rights on account of race or color, except as to Indians not taxed. Now, see, here's the problem. The federal government, out the gate, after the radical Republicans were kicked out of Congress after the 14th Amendment, they literally backtracked this concept that all Native Americans, all Indians, were now citizens. That was the whole point of Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, that all persons born or naturalized within the United States and are under the jurisdiction thereof, that's the key. If they're so Indians are under the jurisdiction, if they're living on American property, or I should say U.S. soil or territory, then they are under the jurisdiction of the United States, then they are U.S. citizens, period, just like the freemen. And, we didn't see it that way. And I'm here to tell you, it doesn't matter. You had to caveat it, because everybody that has been here, that has been under the jurisdiction, because all the Native Americans or Indians, whichever you want to call it, they have all been in the United States at the point of this. Remember, I went through this painstakingly with the previous treaty of Guadalupe, right? Hidalgo, Guadalupe, or whatever. I probably got it backwards. I'm bad with names. But nevertheless, in that treaty, the United States, the continental United States, going all the way up to British Columbia and going all the way down to San Diego and across, other than this little strip of land in Arizona. And I think by the 14th Amendment time frame, that little strip of land became a part of the United States. So regardless, that was the United States territories. And all of that territory was now on skid or on a schedule to become a state. So what that means, folks, is as we look at everything being played out, now we see that all the inhabitants in those territories were under the jurisdiction thereof. Whether they be an Indian, whether they be even the Chinese were brought in as slaves, those persons that were there, because in the Pacific Northwest, now, I don't know if they were under the jurisdiction thereof at that point in time. This was kind of like this one point, all the people that were here at that point. So I think when Washington and the Pacific Northwest started actually bringing slaves in, I think that was probably well after the Civil War, so never mind. But if there were other areas where they were bringing in slaves of different demographics or what have you, then as far as I'm concerned, those people, at the point of the 14th Amendment, they became citizens. Because if they had been born here, at that point in time when the 14th Amendment was ratified, then all people that were born here under that jurisdiction of the United States, they're citizens. Therefore, as we look at this right here and they say except, then this is actually repugnant. What they're basically saying in this Enabling Act, except for Indians, is repugnant to the 14th Amendment. So they were violating that right there. And so as they go forward, the Constitution of the United States, principle of the Declaration of Independence, and said convention shall provide by ordinance irrevocable without the consent of the United States and the people of the said state. Now, what does that mean? And said convention shall provide by ordinance irrevocable without the consent of the United States and of the said people of the state. First, so they're listing these things that they're going to make an ordinance that requires these very specific things. In other words, the federal government is telling the delegates that you have to do this, you have to create this ordinance that inflicts these laws upon the state. Now, near as I can tell, and you understand this because we've gone through the Constitutional Convention, or at least Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention and how they laid out the whole admission of new states coming into the Union. The federal government couldn't meddle with how they had to set their government up. As long as it was Republican in form, as long as it adhered to the Constitution, that's all. So the first thing, which is what we just read last Friday, first, the perfect toleration of religious sentiment shall be secured, and that no inhabitant of said state shall ever be molested in person or property on account of his or her mode of religious worship, provided that polygamous or plural marriages are forever prohibited. So in other words, is this a law respecting religion? Yes, it is. So the federal government wasn't only violating the process of how they were controlling the state coming into the Union, they were actually telling the state to make a law respecting religion, something that they were forbidden in the Bill of Rights to be even to do. Okay, so the second point. Second, that the people inhabiting the proposed state do agree and declare that forever disclaim all right and title to the unappropriated public lands lying within the boundaries thereof, and to all lands lying within the said limits owned or held by Indians or Indian tribes, and that until the title thereto shall have been extinguished by the United States, the same shall be and remain subject to the disposition of the United States, and said Indian lands shall remain under the absolute jurisdiction and control of the Congress of the United States. That's kind of a semicolon creating a break there. So in other words, they identified these areas called public lands. They made sure that everybody knew in the state of Utah what the federal government claimed as their land. Now, there's no amendment, by the way. There's never been an amendment to the Constitution that has allowed the federal government to even create this thing called public land. How did they get here? Well, they used the courts and they used their own aggrandizing to say, well, we can do these things. And they had gotten so drunk on their power that they were literally now basically telling states, especially the Western states, we're sorry. Even though you're a state and you want to be sovereign, we're not giving you your full sovereignty. We're taking your resources. We're going to hold back these things that we know and believe are really gold mines, these things that are absolutely going to help you economically and so forth. We're not allowing you to have it. Talk about labeling, or actually talk about laying a disability upon a state. Unconstitutionally, folks. Now, we've got another part, but I'm going right into break here. So we'll get into the second part of the second paragraph of these stipulations that the federal government is placing upon the state of Utah. The whole point of doing this, folks, is all of these things that the federal government is inflicting upon them, such as the religious practice of marriage or, you know, their access to these lands. So far, they don't have any authority to do any of this. And so the point being, I have no idea why this is in the States National, but we'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let me continue on with these unconstitutional stipulations in admitting Utah state into the Union. That the lands belonging to citizens of the United States residing without the said state shall never be taxed at a higher rate than the lands belonging to residents thereof, that no taxes shall be imposed by the state on lands or property therein belonging to, or which may hereafter be purchased by the United States or reserved for its use. In other words, they're laying this carte blanche blanket over all of the state of Utah to basically say, if we come in and buy it, you cannot tax this. Anyway. But nothing herein or in the ordinance herein provided shall preclude the said state from taxing as other lands are taxed any lands owned or held by Indian who has served his tribal relations and has obtained from the United States or from any person a title thereto or by patent or other grant, save and except such lands as have been or may be granted to any Indian or Indians under any act of Congress containing a provision exempt the lands thus granted from taxation, but said ordinance shall provide that all such lands shall be exempt from taxation by said state so long as such extent as such act of Congress may prescribe. So how much more can you hamstring the state by not being able to have them tax or be able to obtain money to function as a government? It seems like, well, the federal government was literally going gangbusters in laying out their own controls within these states. In other words, folks, everything that they're laying down here in these sections is all unconstitutional. Article 4, Section 3 clearly states that Congress has the responsibility of admitting states into the Union as long as they're Republican in form and that they meet the criteria of how the state boundaries are being formed. It's not within a state, and that very first paragraph like we went through last week. That being said, they have the ability to create needful rules and regulations regarding respecting the territory until it becomes a state. They cannot dictate the laws and what land is the state. When that state is admitted into the Union, it is admitted on equal footing. Folks, as we looked at the convention, Madison's notes on the convention, they were laying it out that there was clearly an argument to say, do you want these states to wage war against you and actually sever their relationship with the Union? Because if you do, the best thing you can do, if you want this to happen, is create a diminished sovereignty so that these states are at a disadvantage with the rest of the Union. So here's the question. why is it that people haven't connected the dots and actually said, hey, you know, all of us Western states, from the Dakotas all the way down, and, you know, why are we allowing the federal government to do these things? Either we become sovereign states with equal footing, that you have no ability to possess or protect, possess or obtain any land within the state other than those few things enumerated in Article 1, Section 8. And then if you do, you have to still pay for it. And then if the purpose of having that land is basically obsolete or it has been, outlived, it becomes overcome by need. In other words, strategically, you don't need to keep a cavalry fort in the middle of Oklahoma anymore. So all of those things get seceded back to the state, period. The point is that the federal government has basically created this sucking chest wound all across the Western states, giving them a huge disadvantage. Anyway, here's the third line. Here's the third caveat. That the debts and liabilities of the said territory, under authority of the legislative assembly thereof, shall be assumed and paid by the said state. In other words, all the debt that has been created by the governing body that's been there. And so here's the question, because I don't know. You have to really look into how and who was sent into the state to regulate it, because the federal government was doing that too. I mean, they did have the constitutional power or the authority to regulate the state, create the needful laws, and so forth. So in other words, if they would have created debt and actually created a disadvantage by, you know, borrowing money or what have you, and making decisions for corporations, this kickback and so forth, I could see how all of this debt was. It's kind of like, have you ever heard of a friend that had a spouse run up a whole bunch of debt and then ask for a divorce and then boom, and basically leave that person who's paying the bills, whether it be he or she, doesn't matter, that they end up getting stuck with the debt. It almost makes sense to me, or it almost seems like a real plausibility that there was a deliberate functioning here where they knew that they were going to stick the state with all this debt that was assumed by these characters that are no longer going to be a part of the state government. Therefore, they want to make sure they get stuck with this debt as a declared declaration in the state constitution or this ordinance that they're going to make. Fourth, here's the fourth provision. That provision shall be made for the establishment and maintenance of a system of public schools which shall be open to all children of said state and free from sectarian control. Now, what does that mean, free from sectarian control? What does that mean? So I think what that means is exactly opposite of what it really means, because I think they're basically saying to make sure that no religion, because sectarian, isn't that a word for religious, right? You know, a form of religion? Yeah, religious or denominational, free from a denominational control. In other words, they wanted to make sure that, because all the new states that were joining the Union up to this point in time, all states joining the Union were basically having a symbiotic relationship with their churches. And their churches were running their schools and their welfare system and so forth. Because, again, you know, at this point in time, we're wrapping up the 19th century, and Utah's joining the Union, and they didn't want the church to be involved in those types of things. This is where, because Utah became a state, I can see why the federal government started doing what it was doing, because they basically wanted to strip the state's ability to use churches to take care of the people and force the state government to do it. In other words, inflict that basically communism upon the states, so that the states provided from cradle to grave, and the concept of cradle to grave became a standard concept in Congress in the 1930s. As a matter of fact, it was two Montanan senators, Montanian or two senators from Montana, whatever the term is, two senators from Montana were actually using that term from cradle to grave regarding health care. So, so they were basically laying out that they couldn't allow the church to actually have any control over the school. This is even before the Scopes trial in 1920. So they were already really reaching out to basically force these evil Mormons into living, you know, without their church being involved in the government and so forth, where all the other churches, you know, or all the other states like the Anglican state churches and so forth, as they were doing. And so I'm just using this, not right, wrong, or different. The fact is that we can see how the government became more and more lustful in attacking religion because of the Mormons, it seems like. I mean, I understand that when we look at certain doctrines, and I understand that, you know, there are people that say, well, that's not Christian. Well, it's not Mohammedan. It's not Hare Krishna. So we got to be really careful because, I mean, that's one of the reasons why we read the paragraph on property, or the essay on property, and Madison's remonstrance on religion, the importance of the individual relationship with Christ, whether you like it or not, until we actually have the true and fulfilled, I think, I don't know what the term is, but there's got to be a term where you actually have the profound true knowledge, no question about it, that this is the truth regarding marriage, regarding this or that. And so I see that we play these games, and mankind has been doing this right out of the Garden of Eden. As Adam's family, Adam and Eve's family, was propagating. I mean, if I remember correctly, and I'm probably wrong on this because I'm wrong about everything probably, around the sixth generation of children, the Adam's children, or there was a large portion or large section of Adam's posterity, became very evil. Six generations. He was still alive. So, as we kind of look at, you know, these things that we, you know, how did that happen? How did they go down that path? How are we continually going down this path of becoming so adamant about how we want to control everybody else? This is why the idea of creating a theocratic constitution is becoming more and more popular amongst people of their own different sex. Oh, we want to have our own. Folks, if you want to have your own, that's where you create your county constitution. You can do that in your county constitution as long as you do not deny or disparage the right of another citizen in your county, the freedom and the exercise of their own religious beliefs. So in other words, if they're a citizen, then they should have the right. This is why I say Mohammedans can't be citizens, because they don't support the Constitution. Anybody that supports the Constitution, you shouldn't have a problem with. You shouldn't have a problem with. And I even say this about Hare Krishnas or Buddhists or what have you. I believe that as far as I see, the communists and the Mohammedans are the only ones that really scream out they will not and cannot support the Constitution. Everything they do is to undermine, destroy, and get rid of and replace with their theocracy, because communism is a theocracy. It is a theocracy that is godless, that the state is your god, kind of like the Egyptian Empire, where the pharaoh is god. So anyway, let me get into section 4, that in case a constitutional state government shall be formed in compliance with the provisions of this act, the convention forming the state shall provide by ordinance for submitting the said constitution to the people of the state for its ratification or rejection, and at an election to be held on Tuesday next after the first Monday in November, 1895, at which election the qualified voters of the proposed state shall vote directly for or against the proposed Constitution. So what I am basically telling you right here is that this is the federal government invoking democracy. What do you think about that, folks? Right here, we actually have the federal government telling them that the only way that this Constitution be ratified is by a democratic vote of the a popular vote by the people, 50% plus one. In other words, if the mob agrees, then the mob can have. That is a democracy. Instead of actually saying, and why is it the federal government didn't want counties? Because they knew counties were on the chopping block. Probably by the end of the 19th century, the federal government understood all of its strategic targets, counties being one of them. They needed to get away from the constitutional constructs and these fundamental tenets of we the people creating, because the intent was moving us more and more towards a statist government. Communism had been alive and well in the United States by this point in time for a few decades. Academically, it was alive and well in the 1880s. As being preached in many of the Ivy League schools. By this point in time, it was already at Berkeley. It was already spread out to most all the higher education, I'll just say, bastions where higher education was being taught within the different states. So, as we lay this out, I'm just here to tell you that they're basically making it so that the people are going to vote in, you know, for their constitution. And let me just get back to what I've said. Tuesday the next, after the first Monday in November, 1895, at which the election, the qualified voters of the said proposed state shall vote directly for or against the Constitution and for or against any provisions separately submitted. So right there, we've got this provision that is invoking a democratic form of government, where up above, they said, provided that the said territory be a Republican in form. Well, hold on here. You can't have both federal government. You can't say you're going to have a Republican form of government, but you're going to create a democracy. The return of the said election shall be made to the said state commission, who shall cause the same be canvassed, and if a majority of the votes cast on that question shall be for the Constitution, shall certify the result to the President of the United States together with a statement of the votes cast thereon and upon separate articles or propositions and a copy of the said Constitution, articles and propositions and ordinances. And if the Constitution and government of the said proposed state are Republican in form, again, they're saying it again, are Republican in form, all the provisions of this act have been complied with in the formation thereof, it shall be the duty of the President of the United States to issue his proclamation announcing the result of the said election, and thereupon the proposed state of Utah shall be deemed admitted by Congress into the Union after or under and by virtue of this act on an equal footing with the original states from and after the date of the said proclamation. Now, hold on, folks. Where in Article 2 does the president have the responsibility and the power to proclaim and admit states into the Union? This is strictly a congressional and perfunctory process. It is there's nothing for the president to do. You don't send, as a matter of fact, when we looked at the process of admitting Vermont and we look at those enabling acts, there was nothing there that said, just submit this to the president and you can join the Union. This is something that has grown over time. And the only way somebody, this would be a body of research for one person to go through the enabling acts and academically lay out when they started starting this practice, starting that practice, and so forth. One of the things I had actually heard by a person, actually, don't know the veracity of this, so I'm only going to share it with you, because I have been told, because I happen to know a member of the church, of the Mormon church, and that person had said that prior to the admission or this enabling act, the federal government went to the church and told them that because Utah was going to join the Union as a Republican dominant party, they needed to make sure there was an equal division of the people supporting both parties. And I had to scratch my head, are you serious? And actually, that has been reaffirmed by somebody, but I still don't have a level of accurate collaboration to actually prove this concept that the federal government actually did this. So I lay it out there. Anybody that wants to provide me the information where they even overstep that in engaging and forcing the Uniparty to make sure the Uniparty had a foothold in this state, because that speaks to this concept of how the Uniparty has been integral in controlling the politics within the states and local communities. Anyway, here's Section 5. You'd think that would be it. No, they've ratified the Constitution. No. Section 5. That until the next general census or until otherwise provided by law in the said state shall be entered to one representative in the House of Representatives of the United States, which representative of the 54th Congress together and the governor and the other officers provided for in said Constitution may be elected on the same day for the adoption of the Constitution until said officers are elected and qualified under the provision of the Constitution. The state is admitted into the Union, the territorial officers shall continue to discharge the duties of the respective offices in the territory. Now, Section 6. Now, actually, regarding that, I believe at this point in time, Utah had 60,000 people. So I'm having a hard time understanding at least 60,000 people by this point in time. Now, I could do the due diligence and go check, but they had to have that, because I know Wyoming had 60,000 people when they joined. The real question is, why is it that they were playing these games on apportionment? Now, do they play apportionment based on household? Or do they play, because right there it says persons in Section 1, Article 1, Section 2, actually. I think it's Article 1, Section 2, where it lays out the apportionments of the states and the ratio of 30,000 persons to one representative. So if there's 60,000 persons, are they citizens? Which meaning, you know, you may only have two kids or however they divvy it up. But how is it that they're actually, I mean, folks, I'm telling you that by this point in time, they were already playing games on the apportionment. And if I remember correctly, the games on apportionment actually happened in the 1870s and the 1880s, where the federal government started creating statutes regarding both the election process of the president and how the party was able to go further and further into the assuming control over the electors and so forth. But in addition to that, they started regulating and making changes and redefining what was to be the apportionment, you know, for the census, how they were going to configure or base that apportionment. Here's the problem. They never really laid this out in the very beginning. And I believe the only way we can actually get to it, because what is the ground truth? The ground truth is covered in the convention, or I should say Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, meaning that Washington felt that 30,000 people, 40,000 people could not be properly represented. So this is why I've said this many times. What is reasonable representation for everybody across the nation? I do not believe 500,000 people is reasonable. I do not believe that everybody would think that they could get their voice heard, because the whole point of a Republican form of government, the whole point of having that representative, is he is giving you your suffrage. And that becomes really clear when we look in context to the Senate, two representatives for that state legislature. So how is it that when we look at the state legislature, that's only 100 people. They get two representatives. And we only have one, or at this point in time, Utah only had one. And there are states today, Wyoming, over 500,000 people. They only have one. Because they've created their own rules. They've redefined these things. This has been completely problematic. Okay, Section 6. That the admission of the said state into the union, sections numbered 2, 6, 32, and 36 in every township of the said state, and which such sections of any other parts thereof have been sold or otherwise disposed of by or under the authority of any act of Congress, the other lands equivalent thereto in legal subdivisions is not less than one quarter section and is contiguous, and may be to the section in lieu of which the same is taken, are hereby granted to the state for the support of common schools and indemnity lands to be selected within the state in such manner as the state legislature may provide with the approval of the Secretary of the Interior, or the Secretary of the Interior. This is this federal secretary of the Department of Interior, the Department of Everything. That the 2nd, 16th, 32nd, and the 36th sections embraced in permanent reservations for national purposes shall not at any time be subject to the grants nor to the indemnity provisions of this act, nor shall any lands embraced in Indian, military, or other reservations of any character be subject to the grants or to the indemnity provisions of this act until the reservation shall have been extinguished and such lands be restored to become a part of the public domain. So they're basically saying we're holding all of this stuff back. They had no authority to do this. They had no authority to enforce Indians to living on this very specific land. As the Indians were living within the territory, I think that they were creating the needful rules and regulations. There needed to be a clean handoff as to how the state would then take what the federal government, the damage the federal government did, and try to repair that in basically welcoming the people to be a part of the state. These Indians as citizens, at this point in time, they're citizens. In 1895, they're citizens. They should have been welcomed, and as a matter of fact, this is what I would have done. I would have granted them that land to actually apportion that land to the people that are alive today to make sure that everybody has their property, their family. So that family is granted to those people that are living on it. There you go. And then the rest of the land that isn't, you know, being portioned so that everybody has an equal and fair shake is equally divided. So in other words, the state would take conservatorship and make sure that no tribal member has any advantage over another member because of their status or anything else, that everybody has a fair shake in getting the best land so that everybody can actually have an opportunity to, you know, to have a productive piece of land, productive property, and so forth out of all the property that was theirs, and transition that to the citizens, these citizens, so that then they would be incorporated into the state. Anyway, we got a lot more to cover. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract. And with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.